You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Joining me on the line is Colin Flaherty, the author of White Girl Bleed a Lot, The Return of Racial Violence and How the Media Ignore It. Colin, thanks for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
Colin, I want to talk about this book. I read the whole thing, and it's pretty amazing. But before I do, for the benefit of the listeners, I just want to read from the book in chapter 42 about the author, because I think it's important that they know who Colin Flaherty is. Colin Flaherty is an award-winning writer whose work has been published in more than 1,000 places around the globe, including the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, Boston Globe, Miami Herald, Washington Post, Bloomberg, Business Week, Time Magazine, and others. He is a former speechwriter for the former chair of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, and also the author of Redwood to Deadwood, a 53-year-old dude hitchhikes across America again. He's also a two-time winner of a Washington Post Award for Spy Novelists, and also, as a reporter, he won more than 40 journalism awards, including Best Investigative from the Society of Professional Journalists in San Diego, for a story that resulted in the release of an unjustly convicted black man from prison. And you live in Wilmington, Delaware, where you do a radio talk show on WDEL Radio with your brother. Colin, I know that was a mouthful, but I thought it was important that the listener should hear that. I'm very interested in this story that you did, this investigative piece of journalism you did that resulted in the release of this unjustly convicted black man from prison. Can you tell the listeners a little bit about that?
Well, he sent my editor of a magazine where I was working a letter saying he didn't do it, and even the judge said the main witness against him was lying. He was convicted of trying to kill his white girlfriend. I said, that can't be true. So I'm going to get this letter, and I'm going to do a story about how people in prison try to lie their way out of prison. So I got the letter, I looked at the transcript, and what he said was true. So I started looking at the whole story. I re-examined all the evidence, found new evidence, new witnesses, and it turned out that the woman who accused him of trying to kill her, she had done the same thing to another guy 1 year before, and it never happened. So really, what you have to do in these circumstances, you go to the person that owns the magazine, and you go, yeah, if this story's wrong, you lose your magazine. Because it's like the reporter versus the judge, the jury, the prosecutor, everybody in the system. It's like 1 on 40. I did the story, showed what was going on, and he got out. It was on court TV. It was a big deal.
Are you still in touch with that fellow?
They sent me a Christmas card. The Christmas card says, Colin, if not for you, I wouldn't have a Christmas. You know, when you're in a state prison, that's the worst place you can be.
Wow. Now, the book, White Girl Bleed a Lot, I was interested in this when I first came across it online because of my experience looking at the news every day and all the websites that I do and what I noticed. Funny, with topics like this that are politically incorrect, for me anyway, when I do the research and I notice a pattern, it's tough to find somebody to corroborate what you're thinking, and you begin to believe you might be going a little crazy or going down the wrong path. But in fact, there is, as the subheading says, the return of racial violence to America. There is a return of racial violence to America, isn't there?
There's a return of racial violence, and the media ignore it. Really, the book's about two things, the violence and the press.
What was it that inspired you to write this book?
Well, my brother and I were doing this talk show, and so we came across a story about an incident in a high school in South Philadelphia, a black high school where maybe 10% Asian students were being beaten up every day for years. And they went to the administration and they said, what is this? And they said, oh, you know, you're imagining it. And so finally, there was a federal investigation and they made them, you know, reverse things. And then I started noticing all these other things happening, which kind of the same thing. There were riots and mob violence in Philadelphia that people were just looking at and going, oh, you know, this isn't anything. I said, well, if you look at YouTube, all those people are black. That looks like a race riot to me. And I showed it to other reporters. And they would go, no, that's not a race riot. Then it kept happening over and over and over until finally I've documented in my latest edition. We've got more than 500 examples of racial mob violence against everybody, really. White people, Asian people, gay people, women, anybody who's kind of weak and the predators can take advantage of. And so I just noticed it was happening all over the place in places you wouldn't expect it. So I thought, you know what? People got to know about this. And so that's why I wrote the book.
Okay. And when was that? What month and year that you and your brother first uncovered this?
I first started looking into this 2 years ago, probably published the first edition of the book. 1 year ago, I published the latest edition about 3 months ago, and WND.com is going to publish the next edition this summer. They're going to make a big deal out of it, I am told.
And I think that the most important part of this book is the fact that it's interactive in nature. So because the media covers, for some reason, these stories up and rarely mentions race, you have where you say, let the video do the talking, right?
Yeah. And I mean, 10 years ago, if somebody would have said all this, somebody would have said, just say, Colin, you're making all this up. So my attitude now is, you know what? So many of these things are on video. They're just hard to ignore now.
Right. And of course, they still are saying you're making all this stuff up, because I did read that chapter about the hate mail that you got from these reporters when you contacted them about your book. Were you offering them a review copy or something like that?
Yeah. You know, a lot of my readers send stuff to the reporters, almost in a way challenging them. They'll say, hey, why aren't you reporting this? So the reporters send the hate mail to my readers and to me. And, you know, you expect, in a way, I guess, hate mail from, I don't know, civilians. But when reporters react with all this vitriol and hate, that was a surprise to me.
Why do you think that is?
Oh, man, you know, this book to me raises so many questions. And the only question the book answers is this. Is that happening? And the answer is yes. Do I know why it's happening? Why all this racial violence is happening? Not really. Do I know why reporters are so heavily invested in pretending it's not happening? No. Do I know the solution? No. Cause? No. But I will tell you that everybody in this country is in such denial about this whole business of racial violence. I thought I wanted to write a book. When you were finished reading the book, you simply could not deny the reality of this book. So this book does not have any opinions, doesn't have any overarching theories or anything like that. It just says, hey, this is happening.
Mm-hmm. And on page 362, that's exactly what Ted just said here. It is just a book that says race riots are happening. Here's when, where, and who, and how, but not why.
Now that my book's been out, you know, a year or so, I get a lot of readers, a lot of cops read my book. They love that book. I also, funny enough, I didn't even know these people existed. I get calls from prison psychologists. And I had a call from the Midwest a month or two ago, and he gave me the best why explanation I've heard. And what he says is everybody in schools now is being taught that black people are victims. They cannot succeed. 400 years of repression. You are not responsible for your actions. Built up this resentment and anger. And that's what he says. And that's the thing that makes more sense than anything I've heard.
And also, I guess, the fact that the media is not pointing the finger at anybody, right?
I don't expect every crime news story to identify a person by race. But now we're in a position where a lot of newspapers all over the country are actively denying that there's anything racial about many of these crimes. It's really weird because I think we're living in the most race-conscious country in the world. Every day, you and I could pick the newspaper up. We can read about the Black Caucus, the NAACP, the Black Teachers Union, the Black Cop Association, the Black Student Union. And that's all good, and nobody says anything about it. But if you bring up the topic of black mob violence or black violence in general, that is somehow taboo.
And it's also important to note that you're not just getting hate mail, you're also getting mail, and you're also getting recommendations for the book, right, from some pretty big names.
It's being well received because of the tone of the book. I don't generalize. I don't stereotype. I also don't apologize. Thomas Sowell looked at it and said, I had no idea how bad it was. So when Thomas Sowell says, you've written something about race that he didn't know about, well, I don't know how you get a bigger compliment than that.
That's what I was mentioning earlier. Because I go through so many websites and see so much of these incidents, it is something that I guess very few people would know about if they're not immersed in it, like I am and like you have been for all these years.
People are afraid to look at it even when it happens to them. There's a woman in Springfield, Missouri. This is the most bucolic place you can imagine, right? You move to Springfield because you want to get away from all these, like, urban ills, you know? Her son was beat almost to death by a black mob of 20 people in Springfield, Missouri. And she was guilty because she noticed all the perpetrators were the same race. Then she found my book. Then she found this is happening all over the country. It's really strange where if something bad happens to you, Dave, you have to be the one to apologize for not liking it.
It's beyond strange. I can't figure it out. The whole psychology of these people, and you have many examples in the book, the people who were beat up by blacks and not wanting to admit it. I don't know. I mean, there's a lot here, like you said. There's a lot here to wrap your mind around to try to figure this stuff out. But I had read an article from 1904 on race relations in the South. And one paragraph caught my interest, and I think it's applicable here to what we're talking about. It says, and remember, this is 1904, so we're talking about, what is that, 110 years ago almost. With a Negro population which has increased in the last 40 years from 4.5 million to 9 million, of whom 8 million inhabit the South and 4.5 million inhabit the six Southern Atlantic and Gulf states, where in large sections they outnumber the whites 2 and 3 to 1, and in some parishes 10 to 1, with this population owning less than 4% of the property and furnishing from 85 to 93% of the total number of criminals. It's tough to get numbers on this, but I think maybe those numbers, not as far as the property, but the numbers as far as total number of criminals, I think that's probably consistent from over 100 years ago. Have you looked into that at all?
The book is not really, we don't do the statistics things, but I will tell you this, that the numbers, statistics on black versus white criminality, violence, crimes against property. They're just as bad and horrific as you want. And so there's really only two explanations. One, it's all caused by racism, or two, it's caused by something else. And most of the explanations people are getting today in all the universities and in the grade schools and the high schools is that this is a product of 400 years of anger and oppression.
That's interesting, because there are some people who put forth the hypothesis that at one time or another, pretty much all of us on the planet had ancestors who were slaves, because everybody was slaves. So I guess maybe these are the most recent examples of slaves, and maybe it's going to take another 400 or 800 or 1200 years for them not to be angry at all the rest of the people who had nothing to do with their ancestors who they didn't even know being slaves, right?
To quote our president, that's above my pay grade.
The whole thing is pretty amazing, but you're from Wilmington, Delaware.
I live in Wilmington now. I've split my time between Wilmington and California, but I've actually lived in California since I was 21, so almost 32 years out there.
Okay, but Wilmington, Delaware is pretty interesting because I have gone through Delaware, being in New Jersey, of course. Wilmington is pretty unique, and I learned this from the book, because in the book you mention a parenting magazine rating of the top 10 most dangerous cities in America. And I brought this up online, and again, because the book's fantastic, because it has all these hyperlinks. You click a button and boom, you're there. But the number one most dangerous city in America, according to Parenting Magazine, was Wilmington, Delaware.
By any way you measure it, Wilmington's a top 10 dangerous place in this country. And it's one of the things we talk about on the air a lot, which is how this new high bar of being dangerous is now the new normal. So on the radio show that I do, I'm constantly reminding people, this is not normal. And I think one of the reasons people have a hard time talking about violence is because violence and being anti-crime is a proxy for race. And to say you're against crime is to somehow take on some kind of racist kind of thing. I don't have any other way to explain why people are so accepting of crime in this little town.
Very strange. The demographics are important in Wilmington. As of the 2010 census, Wilmington is 58% black and about 28% non-Hispanic white. And, of course, a smattering of other races. But anybody could go to Wikipedia and take a look at any town and the demographic and try to draw their own conclusions. But do you think that the numbers have something to do with the fact that Wilmington is one of the top 10 or maybe even one of the top 3 most dangerous cities in the United States of America?
Well, you know, that's a good question. And I don't know a good answer to that other than there's a lot of stuff going on here in Wilmington, Camden, Philly, all these places. Places where you would expect it, and places like Wilmington, Philly, and Camden, places where you wouldn't expect it. Peoria, Illinois. Even the more interesting stuff now is that, okay, so you have a place like Wilmington with lots of poor people, lots of black people, and everybody says, okay, well, that's just the way it is there. That's Wilmington. That's Camden. It's Philadelphia. That's the way it is. What about Peoria, Illinois? What about Indianapolis? What about Minneapolis? Seattle? Tacoma? Portland? Maybe I don't get out enough, but I had no idea that all these places were like centers of hot racial violence. Indianapolis, this month, there have been a dozen examples of large groups of black people running around the downtown beating people up and being violent and lawless. The city fathers are going, hey, we just hired a black police chief a year ago. This isn't supposed to happen here anymore.
Yeah, and that's one of the common threads about all these attacks and all these incidences is that it's usually a group, a mob of blacks from maybe 2 to over 1,000, right?
Over 1,000, Minneapolis, 1,000, Philly, 1,000. A lot of times, maybe it's after a concert or something. But here's the thing. It's like, it's so easy to explain it away. It's like, you know, oh, that's just a gang, or that was after a concert, or that was this, or that was that. It's like, boy, this is just awful and getting worse, and everybody just says it's normal. Well, guess what? I don't think it's normal.
Right. I mean, you've been doing this for quite a bit of time, so I don't know why it is that these reporters have such animosity toward a book that we know that they haven't even read. I mean, it happens in other instances, obviously, because I've seen this happen where people have tried to get a book to report. I would never read that garbage. Don't send me that. Don't contact me again. But didn't you read it first, sir? I mean, or ma'am? I mean, wouldn't it make sense to see if, in fact, there's... And like you said, you're not saying anything. All you're doing is presenting the facts. I guess they don't want to hear the facts. That's what it must be.
You know, here's the thing. If this book is so wrong, this book is so stupid, it should be very easy to just flick it off and point out where I'm wrong. Still waiting for the first one to do that.
Right. And that's what I was going to ask you. Has anybody come forward to refute what you're stating here?
No, because everybody mixes up calling me names with refuting what I'm saying. The only thing that people can refute is me to say, like, for example, I just said there were a dozen examples of black mob violence in Indianapolis in January. If somebody came to me and said, Colin, there was only 11, or Colin, you missed 2, there were 14. That's what I worry about. It's not like these things are defined somewhere anyway. But the only thing I'm concerned about is getting my facts correct. Now, when people say, Colin, there was five Italian people at a wedding last week, got into a fight, why didn't you do a story about that? And, you know, my attitude is like, if there are large numbers of unreported hate crimes going on that white people are committing against other people, I'll write that book in a heartbeat. I'll make a gajillion dollars on that book. But you can get some clown in the backwoods of Idaho throwing bacon at a mosque. We hear about it here. You can get hundreds and hundreds of people doing all sorts of bad things on the streets of Indianapolis, and repeated occurrences over a short period of time, nobody knows anything.
Very strange. You're right about that bacon. Of course, we heard all about that, but here, it's an actual epidemic. And before I read your book, I sensed that, as I said earlier. It is an epidemic, and nobody wants to touch it.
Here's what happens every time. Like, for example, on July the 4th, I heard there was a large group of black people in the streets of Charlotte, North Carolina, July 4th. I looked at it. Sure enough, lawlessness, people getting tear gassed, fighting, all this stuff. All of a sudden, when I make calls down there, everybody's saying, oh yeah, that's been happening here for a long time. That happens every place I go. And they always say, yeah, it's been happening a lot, Colin. I mean, nobody's reporting it here. So I think I'm just getting the tip of the iceberg.
And obviously these reporters are just following the cue of the people that sign their paycheck. I mean, that seems to be an irrefutable point here. But do you think that the entities and the families that own most of the mainstream media in the United States have anything to do with this blackout on reporting what's happening?
I can tell the differences in coverage. For example, Gannett is a pretty liberal paper, and you can tell a Gannett paper from their coverage right away on these things. Nothing going on. My only experience with newspapers is not with the people who own them. It's with the people who work for them. And so to anybody listening to this show, I would ask, if you've never met a reporter or spent any time with reporters, I mean, I teach reporters, I lecture to them at the University of California, and if you've never spent any time with them, here's what they're like. Think of the most liberal person you know. That's the average reporter. That's just what they're like. I mean, that's the rule. They're all like that. They come out of central casting. A lot of them are concerned less with what is true and false, a lot more concerned with what is good and bad. And they're very hung up on the good and bad, and they ignore the true and false.
Strange. You called them squirrely in the book.
Oh, man. Reporters are so squirrely. It's unbelievable.
And you're one, right? You're being attacked by some interesting people. One of my favorite groups is the Southern Poverty Law Center. They masquerade as being some kind of an authority on the word hate. They have these hate maps and hate groups, and of course they get to define the word hate. And I saw this article here from October last year, WorldNet Daily now peddling white nationalism. In addition to its usual anti-Muslim propaganda, the site is now focusing on skyrocketing black and white violence. Of course, I read the entire article, and again, they said nothing about the facts. They said nothing, really, which is incredible. Because it's kind of a long article. To say nothing in the article is pretty amazing. That's quite a talent. But besides the Southern Poverty Law Center, anybody else coming after you? One of the big names?
George Soros has people that work for his groups that write about my articles every time they come out. But they just stick a label on it and they sit around and snicker. But I don't fear the labels. I just fear not getting my facts right. And nobody ever touches me on that. So I'm good with all that.
What would happen as an author, as a reporter, what would happen if you put in the wrong fact? Could you be sued?
You always have to show two things. You have to show malice aforethought, and you also have to show some damages. So I could say you were a no good SOB, but then you'd have to go trot some people out to go, because Colin said I was a no good SOB, my business went down. You know, here's another story that people don't know. Newspapers and TV stations get sued all the time. The insurance companies settle it. For example, there's a newspaper in North County, San Diego. The guy started the paper because a reporter at a small newspaper in San Diego wrote a story about his business, and it said, parenthetically, who filed bankruptcy 5 years ago. Those five words cost that newspaper's insurance company like $400,000.
Wow.
He used it to start a newspaper. Another lesson in journalism law, truth is the ultimate defense.
Fortunately, here in the United States, but there are some countries where truth is no defense. It's pretty amazing. But you grew up in Wilmington, Delaware, as I read on your site. At that time, was the percentage of black to white the way it is now, or was it a little different?
From the part of Wilmington I live in, which is older part of Wilmington, it went from being, it was the classic East Coast city, went from being white ethnic to minority almost overnight. There were lots of conflicts, lots of fights. And it's just a whole different place now, which is okay. It's different. I mean, places change. I didn't have any reason to think it was always going to stay the same. But if somebody wanted to tell me it was better, I would have to say, well, that's worth talking about.
I just throw your book at them. Colin, in that chapter that talked about the replies you got from these fantastic reporters across the country, one was particularly fascinating. This fellow from Chicago, Ravi Bikewal, is that how you say his name?
That's close enough.
All you were trying to do was apprise Ravi of your book and see if there was some interest, and he really went after you, didn't he?
I think sometimes you catch people on bad days, but when you write a book, sometimes you can just write a little note to reporters around the country going, hey, I'm going to be in your town talking about this, so if you think it's interesting, because I got a big chapter on Chicago, I'd be happy to talk to you about it too. And he wrote back calling me all sorts of nasty names, and I don't respond in anger anymore. I'm kind of past that. I actually try to respond in patience. I try to walk the person through what their anger is and what that really means. Everybody's so angry and so uptight about this topic. It kind of shows how powerful and how bad it really is. So he just didn't want to hear it. He just thought I was a bad person for thinking the crime had any racial basis whatsoever, that black mob violence was doing bad things in Chicago. And there it is.
And Chicago, of course, if any listeners don't have their head buried under the sand, then they could find out about Chicago. Chicago is erupting in murders and violence, isn't it?
Chicago's weird. They have a new chief of police there that Rahm Emanuel brought in. So one of his first days on the job, he goes to a black church, and he goes, I'll tell you why we have so much violence in this town. Sarah Palin. I don't even like saying that because it sounds so stupid, but you've got the link to the video. And a few months later, he found somebody else to blame. He blames the pilgrims.
Oh, boy.
And there's a lot of explaining, a lot of blame shifting, a lot of shrugging your shoulders, a lot of everything except there's bad stuff going on out there.
Unbelievable. For me, anyway, I like to approach things with an open mind, and I'll hear anything. Remember the saying that we learned growing up here in the United States, right? Sticks and stones, right?
If you say something to me that's not true, I will tell you why it's not true. Not that you're a bad person for saying it.
Exactly. Any threats against you?
Two threats. One on the air, and one during the commercial break. So at the commercial break, when my brother and I do a radio show, we had the former president of the NAACP in Delaware on, because I brought him on to talk about this topic. And during the commercial, he goes, man, you're lucky it's me here. If this was somebody else, they probably would have punched you in the face by now. You know, I'm a big guy. I do not give people the vibe that they are free to do whatever they want to me. Just the opposite, really. And in Chicago, we're on the big talker in Chicago. I think it was called WGN. And I'm sitting there talking about black mob violence. And sure enough, the other guy they brought on who had not read the book, I mean, within 5 minutes, he was threatening to beat me up because of what I said in the book. So it was like, well, that's ironic.
He didn't read the book.
No.
How about hate email?
I get a lot of cuss words. I don't mind it from the public. I'm just always surprised when I get it from reporters. I mean, that's the astonishing part.
Amazing. How's the book doing?
Oh, it's doing great. I'm getting a lot of good attention. I think, again, people like it that there's somebody out there who can talk about this without sounding like you're a member of the Ku Klux Klan or the Nazi Party or something. One thing I learned from writing this book is how vast and how many nooks and crannies are in the internet. There's a lot of people out there with a lot of crazy ideas. So they're out there, and the book's doing very well. Get good reviews. I do a lot of radio interviews. A lot of people write about it online. And WND's gonna, when they publish it this summer, they're expecting some pretty big things out of it as well.
Cool. Yeah, it is pretty amazing because it's about 400 pages, at least my copy, the fifth edition. And the ebook, it's a little bit more. I think it's 407. But it's pretty amazing because it is very clear. You do not in one instance, not one that I found, and I read the whole thing, not in one instance do you ever state an opinion.
My only opinion is, shouldn't we pay attention to this?
Right. Here's a book with nothing but fact and video. How could people react so violently to that? That's what I don't understand. And I know you don't understand it.
The psychiatrists say we are only as sick as our secrets. And if there's anything we're more secretive about in this country than race and racial violence, I don't know what that is. And I see that all the time. People have these secret and unexamined attitudes, good and bad. It's very intense that they never express. So when they do express them, they come out in a really weird way.
Strange. You stumbled on a hornet's nest here, my friend.
Yeah, it is a hornet's nest. That's why I wrote the book. I thought it was something people needed to know about. So kind of gratified that a lot of people are getting something out of it. Cops force this book on people.
I can understand that because they know what happens out there in the trenches. And they're probably very frustrated about what they're told to do and how they're told to respond, I would imagine.
A lot of cops in Chicago read this book.
Yeah. Listeners, if they want to pick up a copy, where's the best place for them to go?
Amazon's pretty good. You can go to my website, whitegirlbleedalot.com. That'll direct you right to Amazon. Or you can just get it for your ebook. That way you can get the links live when you read it. Or if you get the paperback, the links are at my website, so you can just kind of follow along with it. There's a lot of links. A lot of links.
Tell me about it.
You know, I'm telling you, I'm getting sick of seeing these. I see them every day now. I'm kind of getting sick of it, to tell you the truth.
You mean the violence?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I am too. I got sick of it a while.
It's unbelievable.
I know. First I was shocked, then I was angry. I even a few times, because of the insensible violence, I found myself raising my voice and screaming at the computer a few times, and that has stopped, fortunately. But I'm at the point where I'm kind of a little numb to it. How about you?
Well, you know, here's the place where I think you and I probably get the most upset. Not even at the criminals, the people who do bad things, but at the people who look at what they're doing and shrug their shoulders and go, oh, what are you going to do? The people we expect to take care of this kind of business, they don't.
Right.
The chiefs of police, the newspapers, the social workers, the mayors, not a pretty picture.
No, and I think, and I wanted to mention this earlier, I think that probably a lot of that has to do with the towns themselves. They don't want to bring bad press to them, right?
Like Indianapolis. Indianapolis built this beautiful downtown mall in the 90s. It's one of these places where, you know, you go to a convention or you stay at a hotel and you have all these covered walkways to this multi-story mall, right? Beautiful. Well, the black mob violence is destroying the mall. Nordstrom left last year. A bunch of other people are leaving. And they're freaking out because everything they dreamed of is disappearing now. This is happening in all these cities. Everybody's afraid to have this conversation you and I are having right now. If you and I are booking a convention and we get an article saying it's not safe for our delegates to go to downtown Indianapolis, are you and I going to call the people in Indianapolis and going, what's up with black mob violence? No, you're just going to go somewhere where they are safe.
Right, exactly. And maybe that's good. Maybe this is going to bring this to the attention of the public and they're going to have to address it. That will happen, of course. You know, you're in the vanguard here. You're a pioneer. And of course, pioneers are the ones with the arrows in their backs, right?
I'm not worried about it. I'm fortified.
Let the listeners know why you picked White Girl Bleed a Lot for the title.
White Girl Bleed a Lot, the title of the book, comes from an incident in Milwaukee, another hotbed of racial violence. I had no idea. Really nasty stuff going on in Milwaukee. July the 4th, 50 to 100 black people stormed into a grocery store, stole a bunch of stuff, took off two blocks away. They meet up with 10 to 15 white kids and beat the tar out of them. At one point, the first part's on video, a black woman is standing over a white woman. She's motioning to her friends, pointing down at the ground, saying, "White girl bleed a lot." They all laughed.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. And just like that, white girl bleed a lot, not something like, hey, that white girl is bleeding a lot. No, white girl
bleed a lot.
Yeah. And you know what? Like you have, I've seen so many videos of this activity, this violence. And it's really inappropriate, I think, for people to not look at this for what it is. You have a lot of black people, many of them with their shirts off, if the climate is applicable for that, and a lot of them with phones in their hands, a lot of them with their pants halfway down their butts. The way they're talking is not even English. It's in a way, in a manner that's almost alien to someone who has been brought up in the United States, at least through the educational system. And isn't that enough for people to say something's wrong? I mean, you've seen the videos where they're saying whatever they're saying, or the rap music, it always has the curse words in it and talking about violence. I mean, doesn't it go deeper than just people having an opinion not to, for some reason, bring the facts to their audiences?
What you just said is so important, so huge, so penetrating. I don't think anybody wants to deal with that, especially the reporter types and the mayor types, editor types, because what you just said and what the book about makes one statement and asks one question. For the last 50 years, you've been folding, bending, mutilating, spindling the black family through every kind of crazy social program and housing program you can imagine. We have affirmative action. We have racial quotas. We have protected minorities. When they try to get a job at a city government, you are declared a protected minority. This book asks the question, how is that working out for you? And you know what? I've never had an answer to that question.
And you're not going to get it. Colin Flaherty, the author of White Girl Bleed a Lot, The Return of Racial Violence, and How the Media Ignore It. I want to thank you so much for the time you spent explaining all this to the listeners, and looking forward to speaking to you again, perhaps when the 6th edition comes out, and hearing about all the other nonsense that occurs, all the reporters who send you hate mail, or all of the threats you get, or all the other reasons that people are giving not to hear about these facts. Thanks, Colin.
Thank you, Dave.